Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian in association with sportingbet.com.
All aboard for Football Weekly Extra. Today, the Champions League. From Standard Liège to Substandard Zurich by way of another depressing game from Liverpool. We look back on the midweek action and hail the return of the man who couldn't dribble an armchair, Super Pippo. We round up the week's big news stories, the quotas, the Kenyan, and as we preview the weekend's big games and the Manchester derby, we ask what's the difference between the Royal Mail and Adebayor? They're both regular strikers, but the Royal Mail put faces on their stamps and not the other way round. All that in Football Weekly Extra. It's a good thing it's free. Right, well, on board today then, and a bit of trepidation as I unveil the names, it's Kevin McCarra.
Hello, James.
Hello, Kevin. And James Dudd.
Hi, James.
Hi, James. Season debut for you.
Rightful trepidation, yes.
Yeah, well, no. Listening out for howls of indignation for listeners? None. No, and indeed, who could be upset? I'm told as well that Paul Doyle will be joining us as well shortly, but we haven't seen him yet, but he'll be making a comedy late entrance momentarily, I'm sure. Reece Feet has just offered to go and get Simon Harris. Said, we'll keep going as is for the moment, and Paul will arrive. English clubs, Champions League, let's start there, hey? Champions League, four Premier League sides, they all won. None of them really impressed, though, I think I'm right in saying. Liverpool, same old problems against small sides at home that we saw last year, Kevin?
Yes, I mean, pure sort of saying if Fernando Torres is off form, but I mean, players do go off form. Yeah. And, but in their case, where's the alternative? I guess the answer is Couch scored last night, but a nervy 1-0 victory.
Yeah, against Debrecen.
It just reflects the problems they have in the Premier League, I think.
Mind you, they started rubbish last year as well,
yeah,
didn't they?
Yeah. Well, most teams do. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, you know, Chelsea struggled, but they don't really
You were
care.
There at Stamford Bridge,
I was,
you?
Yeah. I say struggled. I mean, they edged it, but really, they couldn't have argued, couldn't have complained if Porto had equalised.
Would we say that Man United edged it away to Besiktas, or?
Well,
it's a good result.
That's a good. That's more. Yeah, we've moments more difficult. But what a club Porto are, though. I mean, I was reading the Champions League magazine, which is a very good
terrific read. Yeah,
it's a very good read. Mm-hmm. And even the best connected to UEFA.
It's the best thing that comes out of Neon, actually.
No, but it's a splendid magazine. Yeah. And there was a thing in it about the money they've raised. I mean, since 2004, well over £200 million in player transfers.
Porto. Since 2004.
Yeah, since the glory days of Jose.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think they had to pay about £70 million as their share of the Estadio do Dragão stadium.
Right.
So that's obviously been covered. And but they keep on finding more players. I mean, they sell Lissandro, move him on to Lyon, and you know they I think they paid about €2.5 million for him. And got, I think I wrote this down somewhere. Being a professional this morning, they bought him for €2.5 million and sold him for about £30 million ultimately to Lyon.
Right. And they do all this without poaching teenagers from around Europe. That's extraordinary.
Well, they do have the benefit of being able to get people get work permits for South American players that we couldn't get in Britain. But then again, most other clubs, many other clubs could do that, but don't do it as well as Porto do.
Oh, okay. Excellent. Now, in the meantime, James, Arsenal, the most dramatic of the Premier League sides performance in midweek was certainly Arsenal, away to the fifth best team in Belgium. They only just got by with the help of a goal that was... Well, if it wasn't offside, it certainly was a handball.
Yeah, I think Standard Liège were appealing quite widely for that second goal, the equalising goal from Vermaelen last night. But it was a very entertaining game. It was a strangely subdued sort of way that Arsenal won it in the end. With the it's Kanye West.
It's Paul Doyle, everybody. Paul, do put a pair of headphones on. We're just discussing Arsenal. Yeah. Sorry, do go on, James.
Sorry, yeah, it was a very good game. I mean, obviously, they were two down inside 4 minutes.
Yes.
And the second, obviously, a very rather dubious penalty. I think as much as Gallas brushed
I think further review confirms it as a penalty.
I think even upon further review, I think it wasn't a penalty.
He hooked his foot away, and it was a short bit later that he actually tumbled. But
I think he brushed it very gently. The striker still managed to plant his foot in the ground, and then he went down rather easily. That's my own opinion. I mean, I appreciate that it could be deemed as a penalty because he caught him.
Right.
I think I'd like to pause by to admire Arsenal for remaining true to themselves and being eccentric at all times. No other club in Europe would give away a goal with a centre forward trying a flick in the edge of his own penalty area. If you told me beforehand which team lost a goal in that manner, last night, we'd all be unanimous. It was Arsenal, wouldn't it? It was
fantastic in the shambolicness of the flick, the weakness of Fabregas's attempted challenge and then claiming to have been punched in the face, yeah. And then obviously being beaten at the near post by the goalkeeper. But all credit to Arsenal.
Was the flick by Eduardo?
Yeah, it was.
So do we have to excuse it on the grounds that he suffered a bad injury? I mean, that's the done thing, isn't it?
Now the question re Eduardo, who of course then redeemed himself with the winning goal later on, was how come he was playing anyway? Wasn't he banned? Did I miss something?
Flip-flop from UEFA, yes.
Yes, now can you explain that?
No.
All right then.
Well, I mean, a separate appeal body took a different view. But
and the different view was what?
That there had been contact and therefore contact must be a penalty.
All right, but broadly speaking, Kevin, what does this mean? After UEFA has decided to take a hard line on divers, does this mean they are deciding not to take a hard line on it?
They've been overruled by an appeals body, independent appeals body, yeah.
They're conscious of the message this sends each time. That's why they went so heavily on.
It makes a terrible mess. I know you can argue it and say, well, it's a high-profile game, so he ought to be punished. But then everyone's meant to be equal under the law. If you only pick players from big games and punish them, but you can cheat in small games and UEFA won't care. I mean, it's a very, very... It's a difficult policy to implement, and the road they went down, I think, is chaotic.
But isn't the message that they want to send out that no player should hurl himself at an opponent unless he's 100% sure of getting the ball, which Boric obviously wasn't.
Wonk says, should Arthur Boric now get a two-match ban for trying to deceive the referee? I don't think that helps the debate, Wonk. It just strikes me that it would have been better if they'd not got involved in the first place rather than sending out harsh messages and then revealing that they didn't actually mean it, which I don't think will scare anybody. Right. Arsenal, on the whole, though, after two straight defeats in the league, not the most impressive performance at Stanley Age.
I think we can explain that Arsenal, even worse than ever now, they're great with the ball and hopeless without it. I mean,
right.
And this is not the Arsenal way. I mean, we all remember Petit and Vieira and people who were difficult to play against. Mm. I think they're trying to get Alex Song to become a good defensive midfield player, which he has been against lesser teams like Celtic, but he's found out a bit in the higher level games like Man City at the weekend. They still lack that shield in midfield.
So even though they won, you'd still see this as a worrying indication of a difficult season ahead?
Well, I mean, unless they resolve that, I think that is the problem. When they don't have the ball, they're unhappy and they make a lot of mistakes.
Right.
They've improved some aspects. You can see the defence needed improved. I think Vermaelen has been a very good signing. Yeah. I mean, I laughed because he's 5'11", but actually he does cope perfectly well in the air. So despite the fact that Niall Hayden-Gallas was big, they seem dominant.
Yeah.
But the midfield is lacking, and I think they don't really have a genuine centre-forward because they sold Adebayor quite late. I don't think Van Persie really is a centre-forward.
You know? Arsenal following listeners will be posting in no doubt saying, well, hang on, we came back from 2-0 down in Europe. That deserves some credit.
And they had a lot of the main first-team players missing from the game. I mean, obviously, no Almunia, no Arshavin. I mean, they had some key players out of the team. But there's a certain frailty to the team, and I still think they could be, as Kevin said, a striker light.
I must say, I said in my preview,
striker light.
I think I said in my previous season, I was amazed looking at the squad just how much talent they have. They're actually not that far away. There's only maybe, I think they could do without a centre-forward, but they can't do without some resilience in midfield.
Yeah. Just to round off things then, from a British perspective in the midweek games, Rangers. Kevin, you were at Stamford Bridge on Tuesday, yes. But last night you were sat on a sofa in front of the game from Stuttgart.
Yes, a friend called Lawrence, who's German and a Stuttgart fan, came round to watch the game with us. And
how cut up was he to see his VfB held to a draw at home by Rangers?
Like all fans, he could see it coming. He became more and more apprehensive as the game went on. Rangers were terrific. I mean,
the second half.
Yeah, they were hopeless in the first half, but you know, they've only been able to sign terrible financial trouble at Rangers. They've signed one player in the past year, roughly, Jerome Rothen, on loan.
Right.
And, and their captain last night was injured. David Weir couldn't play. So they had to play a guy who's really a midfield player, Lee McCulloch, at centre-half. And still they got a draw and deserved it and hit the post at the end when they could have won 2-1. The goal was hilarious, by the way. It's been described as a 1-2, but I recommend it. Some people should check it out on YouTube or something. Bugera gets the ball, hits it towards Rothen, runs forward and sort of dispossesses Rothen as if he didn't fancy having given him the ball in the first place, and proves himself right by smashing the ball into the net from an angle. And Bugera, of course, is a centre-half, but it's a wonderfully kind of impulsive individual goal.
It was a brilliant goal by the man named Majid. I was trying to think of a clever line about that, but I can't think of anything. Anyway, there you go. Well, that's the first round of the Champions League group stage, and that's probably about as much time as we should give it from a British perspective, but of course there were other games, and big ones, around the continent. We'll be coming on to those right after this. Now, jewel in the round one crown of the Champions League was, of course, the visit of European champions Barcelona to Inter. The big face-off there between Eto'o and Ibrahimovic, they face their former teams, etc., etc., etc. Sid Lowe now joins us on the line from just outside Real Madrid's TV studios. Sydney.
Hello. That's not entirely true, James. I join you from just outside Marca's TV studios.
Oh, okay. And you're doing Real Madrid TV momentarily?
No, I'm doing Marca TV.
Marca
TV studios.
Does that mean the Real Madrid gig is up for grabs at all?
I'll ask him, shall I? There's a very handsome TV presenter who would love a job.
Oh, curses, competition. Oh, well, never mind. Listen, now, we'll talk about Real Madrid in a second, if we may. But first off, the big game in the San Siro on Tuesday. No, it was last night, of course, wasn't it? Wednesday.
Last night.
Now, funnily enough, the Italians weren't overjoyed. I would have thought that Inter holding Barcelona goalless, they would have been happy with that. But and Mourinho certainly said he was. But the Italian press weren't. What was the reaction to the game in Spain?
Well, I think the best way to express it is what Guardiola said after the game, which was 0-0 is not a bad result, but nor is it a great result. I think everybody thinks that there's disappointment that they didn't win Barcelona. But I think there's a sense of satisfaction at the fact that a team as big as Inter, with the money that Inter have got and the players they've got, should just try and defend Barcelona. I think there's a certain degree of satisfaction that Barcelona should have so much of the ball and the vast majority of what chances there were. So, and also the other thing is, I hate to say this and be a real killjoy at this stage, but there's something about the group stages that means ultimately, in a way, it always gets ever so slightly watered down, because I think everyone knows that these two teams will go for anyway.
Interesting. Any view on the Ibrahimovic-Eto'o thing? Neither particularly shone. Which shone less, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think a way of looking at it maybe is to see how much involvement they had and what that means about how much fun they're going to have this year. Because, of course, Samuel was brilliant for Barcelona, got loads of goals for Barcelona, but there's always that temptation, isn't there, to say, well, maybe he got goals because Barcelona created loads of chances. Last night, Barcelona created quite a few chances for Ibrahimovic. He saw far more of the ball than Eto'o did playing for Inter. And actually, Ibrahimovic probably should have had a couple. He had one wonderful chance in the first half. He brought down his chest and thrashed it wide, looking a little bit like he could see the net bulging even before he hit it. And I think maybe there is an argument that says last night Eto'o would have scored for Barcelona, Ibrahimovic didn't. But I think we also saw what Ibrahimovic offers Barcelona that maybe Eto'o doesn't, which is they threw a few kind of fairly aimless balls forward. And he really did impress me, Ibrahimovic, in terms of his ability to bring it down and bring others into the play. There is one thing, though, that really screamed at me about Ibrahimovic, and that is that when he got the ball, it tended to be 3-4, maybe 5 touches before another Barcelona player got it. Eto'o kept the move alive by moving it quicker than Ibrahimovic does, and I think that's something that he's going to have to alter in his game.
Very interesting. Listen, Sid, you've got to get into Marca TV, so I'm just going to ask you, while mentioning quickly that Atletico Madrid had a disappointing result there with Apple, and Sevilla had a good result with Unirea. But what about Real Madrid? A big result. But was it a big performance from them and Cristiano Ronaldo?
Well, they were very impressive. Cristiano Ronaldo scored 2 fantastic free kicks, and that's really, really important because, of course, one of the big things that everybody's been saying is Cristiano Ronaldo's not doing it from free kicks. His free kicks have been flying into the sky.
Yeah, but Zurich's goalkeeper. He fired it straight at the keeper, and the keeper just basically...
Well, unfortunately, that's the thing, isn't it? That's exactly what I was about to say to you. The key is they were playing against FC Zurich. There is one thing that makes me laugh enormously in Marca today is a huge interview with Roberto Carlos saying Cristiano Ronaldo is the best free kick taker in the world. Well, that's like me saying that you're the best TV presenter in the world. I don't know anything about it. Roberto Carlos spent his entire career ruining the reproductive futures of millions of footballers in the wall, but going nowhere near the net, apart from on one very famous occasion.
Nicely put, Simon. Excellent. Well, what are you going to be talking about with Marca TV?
I imagine I'll be talking about Cristiano Ronaldo's free kicks.
All right, okay. And will you be speaking in Spanish or English, can I ask, Sid?
In Spanish.
Oh, fantastic. Is there any way that's available kind of to net following folk worldwide at all or not?
You know what? I honestly don't know the answer to that. My guess is probably not, but I'll ask for you if you're that way disposed.
No, I'm just fascinated. I'd love to see you do that. You're presenting, you're a pundit or what?
No, I'm a pundit.
Excellent. All right. Well, listen, listeners, if you are in Spain, do tune in for that. It's starting any minute now. So Marca TV, and let us know how it goes. We'll speak to you on Monday.
Cheers. Nice one.
I say Monday. Of course, it's Sunday. Sid's gone now, but he's joining us on our live Sunday thing. He's going to be at the Bernabeu, where Real Madrid will be kicking off against, who is it, Jerez, and he'll be joining us live from said stadium. Kevin McCarry, you're going to be joining us live from M something or other, on your way back from the Manchester
some
derby.
Some Mancunian event, yeah, some junction on the M6.
Fantastic. All right, well, we'll speak more about the Manchester derby. That's a big game too, a little bit later on. Paul?
Yes.
Yes. Is this finally going to be the year of the French team in the Champions League?
I don't think any of them will win it, but I do think that the three of them, particularly Bordeaux and Lyon, will present a strong challenge.
Right. It was interesting. We had this three-way Franco-Italian clash. You mentioned Bordeaux, who had a 1-1 draw in Turin. Excellent stuff.
Yeah, if you remember last year, they began their group stages by losing, I think, 4-0 at Stamford Bridge.
Right.
And they really showed their inexperience there, because they played well in patches, but lapses in concentration, etc., and then an inability to recover once they went down. And it was down to inexperience, and Laurent Blanc promised that they learn from it and get better. And they suggested that they have done with pretty much the same team. At Juventus last night, after going a goal down, they rallied, came back to equalise, and by all accounts could have won it.
Yeah, equalised with an offside goal, but hey. Right. The Italian press got quite upset about that. They didn't get quite so upset about Pippo Inzaghi's offside goal against Marseille,
yeah,
which was all seen as part of its charm, you know, to be an authentic Inzaghi goal. It has to be a little bit offside, but you know, loads of headlines about Inzaghi.
Yeah, I believe that the Italian press were also very upset in the run-up to last night's Lyon-Fiorentina game about the fact that Dominic refuses to pick Sebastian Frey in goal. And of course, in the match last night, it was Frey against the current French number one, Hugo Lloris.
And who was better?
Frey pulled off a string of outstanding saves. Yeah. But of course, he has been given a chance, just one chance, mind you, by Dominic, and he committed a howler in that game.
Right.
Friendly in, I think it was in Ukraine, if I remember correctly. But suggests he certainly deserves further chances.
Paul, he's come a long way, Sebastian Frey, since the time that he injured himself diving into a swimming pool without any water in it. back in his time at Inter. Kevin, sorry.
That's boring by comparison. Paul, we were talking about Lyon earlier on. I mean, like Philippe Auclair, France football, quite fancies him for the Champions League this season. Why wouldn't they be able to do it? I mean, they keep on buying players. They've now got Lisandro Lopez and Alexis Oco from... It's a big squad, isn't it? And not a bad squad. Where, I mean, they tend to get knocked out in the last 16, don't they? That's the usual story, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think their best chance in recent years to win it was when Gerard Houllier was in charge. I think that's when they had the best squad who were seasoned European campaigners, and they were actually winning on away goals in the San Siro in the quarterfinal. And Houllier, as is his wont, went ultra defensive, and then they ended up conceding a late goal and going out. This year, I mean, no one expected them to be quite this good this year, because they showed all the signs of being in decline last season, and for once, all the summer signings that they'd made didn't pay off. People like Abdelkader Keita and were flops.
This was last year.
Mm-hmm. This season, they really pushed the boat out, as they say, and they made a lot of big money signings, such as Ali Sissoko, as I say, and Lisandro Lopez. And they've been instant hits, which suggests that they're gone back to their canny transfer market operating. And they have a guy, they've replaced Juninho, who people thought would be impossible to replace, with a youngster who they actually signed last season, but now he's come to the fore, called Pjanic, who scored the goal last night. I think he's only 19. On their day, they can be very, very good. I'm not sure whether they have the strength and depth, as they said, to go all the way.
Bizarrely, Sissoko was going to be signed by Milan. He went and had a medical, and they turned him down. At least this was a story they put out, because his teeth weren't good.
Yeah, apparently that affects your posture and causes pains in the lower back if your teeth are wonky in a particular way.
If you chew the wrong way, it messes. Yeah. James,
I'm just intrigued. So how are his teeth now?
I don't know.
It's a worry, though. Isn't
presumably,
it?
They brought him to a dentist. Right.
Couldn't they remove his teeth? I mean, it'd be quite cruel, but couldn't you just take them out?
Right. Well, or you could give him some kind of dental apparatus. Wouldn't be the first football player to get a brace, of course, he said, wheeling out a very old joke. Sorry about that, everyone. Milan, in the meantime, got their season finally underway, in a manner of speaking, with a 2-1 win away to Olympique Marseille. And given the disastrous state of things at the Rossoneri going into this game, this was quite a result, quite a surprise for them. The only victory from the Italian side in the Champions League. And of course, it was all about the fact that Ronaldinho was dropped by Leonardo, the manager, and a certain Pippo Inzaghi was dusted off at 36 years of age. That's 3 years older than the next oldest striker in the Champions League this season, apparently. And there he is, 68 goals now in Europe. That's just one short of Gerd Müller. Now, the man's a phenomenon. Pippo Inzaghi. I mentioned back at the start, Jorge Valdano described him as he can't dribble an armchair. And there's loads of people saying he's the worst footballer they've ever seen or trained with or whatever. But yeah, brilliant goals, as usual. One, as I say, offside. But the second was fantastic.
That would be interesting to see his stats for offsides throughout his career. Yeah. I'd say he's considerably well ahead of everyone else in the world.
Well, indeed. But good on you, Pippo. Milan facing Bologna this weekend, so a chance for them to increase their points tally in the Serie A. Fiorentina, meanwhile, who were penalised in their game at Lyon by an early and I think rather unjust red card for elbowing for Alberto Giardino, who wouldn't hurt a fly, I think we were all clear on that, will be at Roma in a big game in Serie A. That, and possibly some big shake-ups there in their ownership situation, but that's a bit dull and before everyone switches off. Let's just move on then to some posts. Hey. Hidetoshi Nakata, but not the real one, I'm guessing, posting in saying, AC Jimbo, what's your opinion on Parma this season? Nice to see Parma back, isn't it? You know, one of the big names of the 90s in Serie A.
Yeah, I remember growing up and watching you on TV with Parma, James.
That's so right. I was
not to make
young
you feel
well.
Old or anything.
No, I was even younger than you were at the time. Parma, they looked pretty good against Inter when they lost 2-0, of course. Is Alberto Paloschi the next big thing after Mario Balotelli? Well, the interesting thing about Paloschi and Balotelli, of course, is that they're quite young, and as such they tend to stand out when they do get on the field for a big side, as Paloschi was at Milan when he made his debut in Serie A and scored after just 18 seconds, famously. I can't remember who against. It was either Siena or Catania or something. But anyway, it was a remarkable thing. But he's had a brilliant record with Parma since then. His goals helped them up to Serie A this summer. And he's already scored 2 in 3 games so far. And it's interesting how Parma are going to do this year because they've packed. They've now been taken over by this kind of local businessman, Tommaso Girardi. And he's basically bought in loads of really experienced players like Cristiano Panucci and Valery Belzhanov, who I know did nothing for City, but had a great record back in. Oh, and Zaccardo as well, the World Cup winning defender with Italy and stuff. So there you go. There's also Antonio Miranda is good. I've lost everyone's interest again, but I'm just saying that Parma, far from being a relegation fodder, which they were for year after year after year before they finally went down, actually looked like quite a solid mid-table side. And good luck to them because I think we all like Parma. Portlander, question to the podders. Has being on the pod and getting the direct feedback from listeners changed the way you approach your writing? Kevin McCarra.
No, I'm too old to change.
Really? Paul Doyle.
No, I don't read the feedback.
Do you think Simon Hattinson would have changed his approach to writing after the direct
I did
response?
Read that feedback because someone brought it to my attention that there was a lynching in progress.
An 8-page lynching.
And I actually listened to the podcast, which I don't normally do. I didn't think he was
you
that bad
You don't normally
at all.
Listen to the podcast. No.
I think, James, to be fair, anything anyone says to you, whether it's a blog or anything, it might have an impression on you if it's something you've never thought of before.
But, right. What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given in terms of sports writing, Kevin?
Stop. Don't use so many big words.
Right, okay. Tom Chack says we've made a grievous error about Bahrain. I think, we might have been a bit casual about this. I might have suggested inadvertently that they might be one of those teams with lots of Brazilians. But he points out, and indeed Manama Mike as well, who's a Bahrain resident, Bahrain's progress over the last few years owes instead to the nurturing of native talent. There are a few naturalised players are Africans, but native sons like Ala Hubeil are more important. Manama Mike points out the big nations may scoff at small nations fighting their way through to the World Cup, but the impact it has on the people in a small nation is amazing. The achievement to get this far and to be ranked 64th in the world when we only have something like 5 grass pitches in the whole kingdom is amazing. Bahrain, he points out, like this is something impressive, is ranked 3 places higher than Wales. Well, there you go.
Is that something you should be really excited about?
Tell you what, I mean, have a pop at Wales, why don't you? But Bahrain, I mean, of course they're not through yet. They've got to beat New Zealand. Who are the All Whites, is that right?
White.
Is, is football the main sport in Bahrain? What else do they do?
Camel racing.
Right.
I'm not joking. I'm sure
bet they're better
at
Wales than that as well.
Huh?
I bet they're better than Wales than that as well.
Oh, dear. In other World Cup news, actually, we were just talking about Bahrain. I don't know if you saw this story about Argentina. We've been talking a lot about Maradona and his problems. And apparently there's this campaign to get Pep Guardiola on board as the Argentina manager from 2010, so after the next World Cup, assuming they make it. In the meantime, one or two kind of machinations behind the scenes, because Maradona's actually away. One of the big criticisms of him is that he never ventures outside of Argentina or gets off his bottom, goes and looks at some of the big stars who are playing in Europe. But he has actually come to Europe now, but it's to take a dietary cure at a top spa somewhere.
Yeah, it's an awful thing. He's done this in the past, hasn't he? Various procedures to try and reduce his girth.
His doctors have sent him over to lose some of the fat, because he's really been putting on the pounds.
Yeah, it was huge in the looking TV pictures.
Right. Yeah. But while he's away, they've got a friendly coming up against Ghana in preparation to the really big penultimate World Cup qualifier, which is against Peru. And somebody else, Carlos Bilardo, the former Argentina manager, has been delegated with choosing the players. So he's actually going to be doing the call-ups while Maradona's away. And yes. I know it's been kind of played down, but it does seem like a little bit of a shoving Maradona to one side.
It'll be interesting to see if he obviously goes with the same names that obviously Maradona went with for the last Argentina games, because obviously he went with Palermo, which was a bit of a surprise for many people.
When they were 1-0 down against Paraguay, chasing the game, 10 minutes to go, he threw on a 36-year-old centre-back making his international debut.
Yeah.
Didn't I see you being scathing about Maradona and one of the minute-by-minute things?
Well, just watching the Inter match last night, there was Cambiaso, Samuel and Milito, who he doesn't call up. No. And you look at who he does call up in their place and you wonder why.
Hmm. Why indeed. Sorry.
I'll just say, whilst you're on South America, it's just an interesting thing I saw yesterday. That I think the entire Bolivian team, national team, has gone on strike. Or resigned indefinitely, I believe, in protest at the state of the nation's game. I know they can't qualify for the World Cup at the moment, but they might not have a team for the remaining qualifiers.
Right, that's interesting. Possibly. They're just not going to turn up and play?
Apparently so, yeah.
Mm-hmm, okay. They're either bottom or penultimate in the South American group, aren't they?
Yes, they're not in the shake-up.
Well, there you go. Now, Uli Cantrell says, he's talking about the quota. I don't know if we want to discuss this, because it is a bit dry, but it does promise to have quite a big impact if it goes through as currently being outlined. As of next season, clubs will be required to have a squad named of up to 25 players, of which no more than 17 can be over the age of 21 and not homegrown. In other words, you need to have at least 8 homegrown players, i.e. players who have been within one of have had their kind of footballing education in the same country between the ages of 18 and 21. Is that right? Jeepers, it's complicated. That means a club will need to have at least 8 homegrown players in their first team squad by the start of next season. Uli Cantrell asks, have Chelsea got 8 homegrown players in their senior squad? And how can they rectify that if they don't get their transfer ban overturned?
They had 3 youth players on the bench on Tuesday.
Isn't it a bit contradictory, though, this ruling, when they're talking about clamping down on trial trafficking, as they call it? Because this just means that they'll sign all these players much younger.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, when is a homegrown player a homegrown player? I mean, you see many Premier League clubs will pick up a player who may have been, I was going to use the word groomed, makes it sound much worse, but who's been sort of nurtured their talent through at a Football League club or even around the world and bring them in at a like 14, 15-year-old and then they bring them through their youth team and then all of a sudden they're a homegrown player. But
the example of Arsenal, who have only 4 players of English or Welsh descent in the squad, somebody else has done the research on this clearly, but they would still be able to qualify Cesc Fabregas, Gael Clichy, Fran Merida and Carlos Vela, who have all been with the club since a young age, under this ruling. So not really sure how it helps. One suspicion is that the long afternoons drag by a bit there at UEFA headquarters in Neon, so they've come out with this or that new one about 5 match officials, which will be debuting today in the Europa League. Or it possibly did already in the...
They've had trials with it, yeah. But no, I was at Platini was talking about it when I was over in Monaco for the Champions League draw, and
he's excited.
He was quite insistent. There's no problem, you know. There's no question of people disagreeing or kind of comedy events happening with confusion between the officials. You know that he seemed sure that everyone.
Who will have the last say? Will it be up to the referee still, or will the man behind the goal he can overrule stuff or what?
No, I think the referee has the last word still. I mean, you can't undermine the referee, but he's talking about where they would be positioned behind the goals and this kind of thing.
You know. It might work, you know, it might.
I mean, obviously, they have to communicate with each other, and you wonder if there's too much conversation, it'd be quite confusing, you know, messages being going backwards and forwards by microphone. They're all mic'd up, obviously,
right,
to make this possible. It's on TV today. There's various Europa League games on telly, so you can judge it for yourself.
Everton, AEK, CSK Sofia, Fulham, Hapoel. Will they make Hapoel crumble?
I think, as Kevin mentioned, the communication issue is interesting because, yes. I mean, you get an awful lot of, sort of miscommunication with, like, with fourth official, with the assistant referees already, as it is with sort of different perspectives on the same incident. I mean, there's going to be confusion. There's going to be controversial incidents starting today. It's inevitable.
Yeah, excellent. That should be entertaining. Look forward to that. Brilliant. Big weekend in the Premier League. Of course, we'll be getting onto that right after this. Now, we mentioned the live pod that we are doing against All Better Judgment on Sunday. That's at 6 o'clock. Before that, if you're hungry for more European roundup and review, then I'll be having a quick perusal of the papers, Shay, the Guardian's website, as from later on Thursday. A little bit of a look at the continental reaction to the Champions League. And that meantime, Premier League, this weekend, all sorts of exciting games. Arsenal, Wigan's not one of them, probably. West Ham, Liverpool. And this gives me the chance to mention something that various people have been posting in on. Ask Technica, I think, at Ed Thornley. Carlton Cole's ruled out goal. Would it be one of the biggest incidents of last weekend, asked Ed Thornley, if it had been in a higher profile match?
I think it's a shameful incident, really.
Explain for anyone who missed it what happened. Kevin, for example.
Well, basically, Carlton Cole went round and was putting the ball into the net, and about sort of, I'd say maybe 10 yards out from the goal, as he was about to tuck it into an open net, the referee's whistle blew.
For half time.
It was a tough decision. I mean, you can't even imagine how ballistic the likes of Benitez, Ferguson, Wenger and co would have been going had it been in a so-called big match in the Premier League. It was a bad incident that went past. And West Ham were very unlucky not to win that game, and they'll provide a good test for
Liverpool. They ended up losing 1-0 to Wigan. The only explanation I've seen for it is that the referee was aware of the fact that the free kick, which had led to this golden goal-scoring opportunity, was actually, he should never have given in the first place. So when he saw that a possibly match-winning goal was going to result from his error, he decided to just blow the whistle and cancel the whole thing.
The other explanation is that time might have been up. Was it Clive Thomas in 1978 who ruled out Zico's header just as it crossed the line?
The idea that it's all family judgment, it's just a total guess, isn't it, how much time should be allowed?
Well, I mean, they have two watches on, they're keeping track of these things.
Now, beyond that, some huge games this weekend. Kevin, you're going to be at one of them, the Manchester Derby.
Yes, indeed.
1 o'clock on Sunday.
I've been a sceptic about Man City up until now, but you can't really argue with results, can you? However, as regards winning at Old Trafford or even drawing, I'm still doubtful. I saw United last week at Tottenham, and they were really fired up and determined in a way they hadn't been earlier in the season. And they had good performances all over the team. Fletcher, obviously, and Evra and Rooney. The difference now may be that they can't win games all that easily. I mean, Ronaldo's not going to pop up and score a couple of beautiful goals. And they seem to have to strain much harder. But they really dominated Spurs and made you realise that if Spurs do have pretensions to the top four, it's going to be a hard battle.
You say you can't argue with results, and Manchester City, of course, won all their games so far. But...
Yeah,
Adebayor is out for three games.
Yes,
he's scored 6 goals in his last 5 Premier League starts. He's not playing in this one. Tevez is out with a knee injury. Robinho is injured. Santa Cruz, I believe, is injured as well, which just leaves
Craig Bellamy.
Oh dear,
Craig Bellamy. Yeah.
Well, you know, could it work?
Well, possibly. I mean, I wasn't much thinking about players
James
missing.
James Dartshinky, he said, it could have been a huge matchup. This, but when you're shaking your head, James. The fact that they are so stripped bare up front.
I just think, losing £100 million worth of striking talent, you're going to miss it eventually. But all credit to City so far, their season, they've been fantastic. I just see them coming up too short on Sunday.
All right. Paul?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, I haven't looked at the fixtures to see who United are playing next week. But after the penalty incident between at Old Trafford when Arsenal went there, and then Luka Modric missing when they went to Tottenham, and now all these strikers out when they go to City, United are having a lot of luck so far.
It's a bit like Juventus back in the Modgi days. When they used to. There was no match fixing in the sense that they never kind of said, OK, this one's going to be 2-1 or whatever. But one of the things, the key weapons in the Modgi arsenal was that he would ring up the referee or get rung up the referee of whoever their next opponents were playing before facing Juventus and say, can you make sure that certain key players end up being suspended by the time they face Juve.
Not that we're suggesting that's going on.
Well, that's clearly not what's going on there, but it's just interesting. That, yeah. Anyway, as is, the big game coming up at Stamford Bridge. Chelsea taking on Spurs straight after the Manchester Derby, and even more importantly, straight before we do our live podcast. Pete Kenyon, gone. Is that fallout from Kukuka Gate, or is it just because he's been out of favour for a while now?
Well, I mean, people's also there's this criminology thing with Chelsea.
Kremlinology.
Yeah. There's this thing with people say about we've seen for months, so Kenyon's no longer part of the inner circle. I don't know why. Is it because he hasn't made them the richest club in the world and cleared all their debts or whatever?
Right.
But it wasn't a surprise. I had been talk of him being sort of more estranged.
Well, when Scolari was fired, he was away on holiday, and that was seen as being a bit of a Khrushchev going to his dasher moment.
He had advocated appointing Scolari, and apparently that's when Abramovich first started to question his judgment.
So right.
He was edged out of football matters, as you can see.
Now, Spurs, who are coming off a bit of a hammering from Manchester United last weekend, taking on this very pragmatic Chelsea outfit. Prawns, on reflection of last weekend's game, says, when can we expect the Harry Redknapp, Robbie Keane angst to be addressed by the media? This time last year, Rafa Benitez was being castigated for playing Robbie out of position or taking him off after 60 or 70 minutes. But brilliant Harry seems to have decided to do much the same thing, well, nobody's making a fuss.
You could castigate him for playing Robbie Keane at all, because Keane has not played well since he's been back.
Well, I mean, I think actually, no one reads the Guardian, but I did mention my match report, what a mistake it had been to play Robbie Keane on the left, as if he was an equivalent to Luka Modric, which he obviously isn't. I thought he picked a bad team, I think, to play three forwards against Manchester United, you know, was giving United to that an awful lot of the ball, which they then put to fairly effective use. And Redknapp is not a gullible person. He must have felt he wanted to have Crouch and Defoe and Keane all in the one team. And certainly, you know, Crouch and Defoe were quite good, but Keane was hopeless. And I would say it's even worse than since he came back. He wasn't any good for Liverpool. I mean, he lost form there and hasn't recovered it. It's a strange situation.
Redknapp has a good record against Chelsea. I think in general, but certainly since he went back to Spurs... But they don't have Luka Modric again, but they do have Jermaine Defoe, who's in brilliant form.
Yes, I mean, the last thing he said is that after that game that we get him was that he certainly wasn't going to be as adventurous at Stamford Bridge. So I think Defoe may have to play on the break, and he'll have Carvalho and Terry in his case. So if you think that he's basically not really a top quality goal scorer and lab score goals at a lower level, then this is his chance to show different.
Indeed so. James, any thoughts on Spurs at Chelsea?
No, I totally agree with Kevin. It's a real marker point for Defoe this weekend, I think.
Right, okay. And for Spurs?
I think the marker point was last weekend.
Interesting. Equally, Chelsea is a chance for them to really, shift up a gear.
Well, it's the strongest team they've played so far. Because I think they have played well in certainly I saw them against Burnley, and it was only Burnley, but they played really well. And this incredibly fluid midfield that Ancelotti is cultivating really worked well, and they could have scored 10 goals in that game. But they so far they've beaten, winning at Stoke is a good achievement, but Spurs are probably the strongest team they've faced so far, so it'll be... lay down a marker, is that what you said?
All right, well, excellent. There are one or two other games, of course, of interest. Everton conceivably might finally get some points. They are hosting Blackburn. And as I mentioned, West Ham, Liverpool. West Ham a little bit unlucky last weekend. Liverpool yet to really impress, I think I'm right in saying. Is there a chance of an upset there, perhaps?
There's a lot of unrest, especially talk to Liverpool fans who actually wonder if they're going to make the top four, you know, for Champions League place next season, partly because one player's gone in Alonso and the other one hasn't really arrived in terms of playing, Aquilani, and no one really knows until he comes into the team, but still there's this dependence. Torres and Gerrard have got to do it.
Right, although Benny Yoon is, chipping.
Yeah, he's done well, yes. I mean, he's really come to the fore. A very talented player, he's always been, but consistency is what you were maybe looking for from him. But West Ham, you know, many clubs are crushed by these sort of financial clouds and undercurrents, but they seem to go about their business, and they've got a reasonably solid squad. Maybe they can't add to it, I'm sure they can't add to it, but it's good enough to see them through, and I think they're well managed.
West Ham for a win, James?
I reckon they'll get pipped on the break.
All right then, pipped on the break. Sounds fun. Does that wrap things up for today's Football Weekly Extra? Certainly does. Many, many thanks then to Paul Doyle and to James Dar and Kevin McCarra, who will be joining us on Sunday. Let me just remind you again, at 6 o'clock we'll be live in all our unedited glory, streaming on the Guardian website. And it's an interactive show as well. That's the plan. So we're going to be welcoming your tweets and posts, and you can also get in touch with us through Facebook, and we'll be responding live and in real time to your messages and comments. If you go to the Football Weekly page, though, it'll explain about how to quite literally interact with us. Anyway, that's Sunday at 6. Hopefully you'll be joining us for that. In the meantime, from all of us here, it is goodbye.
Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian, in association with sportingbet.com.